This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Taliban fighters have taken control of much of the capital of northern Afghanistan's Kunduz province. AP correspondent Karen Chamez has more.
Locals walk past burnt-out buildings around Kunduz's central market area. Government officials said fighting between insurgents and government forces had taken place around the governor's office and police headquarters in Kunduz. However, there were later reports that the Taliban had taken over the two buildings. Kunduz is a strategic crossroads, which if it falls would be a significant gain for the Taliban as it provides access to most of the north as well as to the capital, Kabul. Meanwhile, airstrikes damaged a health clinic and high school in southern Afghanistan's Helmand province, targeting Taliban positions. A Taliban surge has intensified as US and NATO troops wrap up their withdrawal from the country. In response, the government have retaliated with airstrikes aided by the United States. I'm Karen Chamas.
An upcoming UN report on climate change gives the international community its clearest ever warning about the dangers of accelerating climate change, Britain's COP26 president said Sunday. The chief for the November Climate Change Summit told the Observer newspaper a report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, due on Monday, would show the world was on the brink of potential disaster. He said, quote, "We can't afford to wait 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. This is the moment," end quote. He added that unless nations act now, quote, "we will unfortunately be out of time," end quote. Hundreds of Greek firefighters fought desperately Sunday to control wildfires on the island of Evia that have charred vast areas of pine forest, destroyed homes, and forced tourists and locals to flee. The civil protection deputy minister said Sunday in all 17 firefighting aircraft were fighting the fires on Evia, the second biggest Greek island. This is VOA News. The Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games have come to a close, with the U.S. topping the medal standing once again. Correspondent John Leatherby has more.
Kara Winger of Seattle, a four-time Olympian in javelin, led American athletes into the Olympic Stadium to close out the 17-day event in a ceremony rich in Japanese tradition, but due to the pandemic, attendance confined to athletes, coaches, and officials. In all, the U.S. finished first in both total gold medals and overall medal count, 39 first-place showings and 113 total medallions. IOC President Thomas Bach called on the world to meet again in Paris in 2024 as the Olympic flame was extinguished. I'm John Leatherby.
The head of the United States' second largest teachers union said Sunday teachers should be required to get vaccinated against COVID-19 to protect students who are too young to be inoculated. This shift course back to mandated shots as more children fall ill. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, told NBC News' Face the Nation, quote, "The circumstances have changed," end quote, adding, quote, "It weighs really heavily on me that kids under 12 can't get vaccinated," end quote. The number of children hospitalized with COVID is rising across the country, a trend health experts attribute to the Delta variant being more likely to infect children than the original Alpha strain. Israel set up rapid coronavirus testing stations across the country Sunday, a National AIDS Society said, as the government tries to prevent another pandemic lockdown. The testing centers are aimed at the non-vaccinated and those who have recovered from the virus and need a health pass. Since Sunday morning, unvaccinated people must present a negative COVID test less than 24 hours old, and health passes will be extended to children under 12 starting August 20th. Saudi Arabia will begin accepting vaccinated foreigners wanting to make the Umrah pilgrimage, authorities said Sunday, a move that will boost an economy hit by the COVID pandemic. Starting Monday, Saudi Arabia will begin, quote, "gradually receiving Umrah requests from various countries," end quote, the Saudi press agency reported. This nearly 18 months after it closed its borders to battle coronavirus. Before Sunday's announcement, only immunized pilgrims residing in Saudi Arabia were eligible for Umrah permits. A sheriff says the governor of the U.S. state of New York, Andrew Cuomo, could face misdemeanor charges if investigators substantiate a criminal complaint filed this week accusing him of groping an aide at the governor's state residence. The sheriff promised Saturday a very comprehensive investigation into the woman's claims. The governor denies the accusation. Via remote, Diane Roberts.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga.
I would consider at least two-thirds of those in the voting age to register as a minimum. Emma Tsaye is fully aware of this and therefore he has extended the deadline.
Libya's voter registration for planned elections in December has been extended 2 weeks until the 17th of August.
We cannot and we should not accept countries that have already used most of the global supply of vaccines, using even more of it, while the world's most vulnerable people remain unprotected.
Countries, mostly in the developed world, get ready to provide booster shots as new and more potent coronavirus variants emerge. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Emad Saher, the head of Libya's High National Elections Commission, says voter registration for planned elections in December has been extended 2 weeks until the 17th of August. Registration opened on July 4th and raised the total to over 56% of eligible voters out of Libya's 6.9 million population. Meanwhile, Saif Mohamed Gaddafi, son of Libya's former ruler, has announced, as the New York Times says, his intention to re-enter politics. He is still wanted by the International Criminal Court for alleged crimes against humanity. Wolfgang Puzai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed these developments with VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi.
The acceptance of the results of the election will widely rest with the voter turnout and with the amount of actual or perceived election fraud. Keeping in mind that the turnout of those registered on the voting day has been always low in Libya, just about 22% at the current local elections, this figure of 56% is certainly not enough to provide credibility. I would consider at least two-thirds of those in the voting age to register as a minimum. Emad Saye is fully aware of this and therefore he has extended the deadline. Thereafter, there will be also 30 days for Libyans living abroad to register. Although the number of those registering are currently for the time being quite low, there is also a positive sign. During the last week, there were so many new registrations, up to 30,000 per day, that the registration system faced even technical problems.
Saif Muammar Gaddafi, son of Libya's former ruler, overthrown in the 2011 revolution, who is still wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, has announced, as New York Times says, his intention to re-enter politics in Libya. Despite being cautious about whether he is running for president, he believes that his movement can restore the country's lost unity. Does he stand a chance for Libyan presidency, especially if he relied on nostalgia for his father's dictatorship as an alternative to division and infighting?
That's difficult to say, but I believe rather no. However, the more the situation in Libya gets more challenging for the population again, the better his chances would be. Just to name a few, the security situation is slowly deteriorating in some parts of the greater capital of the greater Tripoli area and western Tripolitania, some major fighting almost every second or third day. But also in Benghazi and in south, the situation is deteriorating. There is an ongoing electricity crisis with very long blackouts. There are sabotage acts on the man-made river, endangering water supply for the coastal areas. So the more challenging the situation is getting, the better his chances would be. But the ICC warrant is certainly a major problem for Saif. Even if he were to run and get elected, the ICC would seek to execute the warrant. And there is the example of Kosovo's President Hashim Thaçi, who needed to resign after he was indicted by the ICC just last year. Saif would not be able to travel abroad, with a few exceptions of the countries not recognizing the ICC. But even more important, if he would be elected, this would almost certainly mean a return to major violence, as many of the 2011 Duvar, the revolutionary fighters, would never ever accept him. I predict that probably some of them would already try to assassinate him during campaigning.
Khaled al-Mishri, the president of Libya's High Council of State, told the New York Times that elections are not likely to heal the rift between East and West and may even steer the country back toward war if they elevate one of its most divisive figures, and Saif al-Islam al-Qazafi may be the most divisive of them all. What could be the scenarios if the presidential elections were basically a contest between General Haftar and Saif al-Qazafi?
Even if both Haftar and Saif would candidate, which is far from sure, I don't expect both of them in the runoff vote, as they would be pretty much after the same kind of voters. Actually, if both of them would run, this would probably limit the chances of each of them to make it into the second round, because they would steal each other the voters. Not only Khalid al-Mishri, but also other prominent Islamists like Abdurrahman Shweli from Misrata, al-Mishri's predecessor as a High Council of State chair, and great Grand Mufti Sadiq al-Gharyani already announced that they would reject and even fight election winners like Haftar and Saif. And this must be certainly taken for serious. Currently, I don't see any candidate who could gain the trust all over the country, especially if the voter turnout will be low. I can only recommend to the international community to urge all the Libyans to register and to vote, and to provide an efficient international supervision of the ceasefire before it is too late. There is a very deep split in the country. I would say Libya could only find to stability through a federalist system, preferably based on the old constitution as an interim tool. This old constitution should be re-implemented by the new House of Representatives very soon after the elections, if they take place.
That was Wolfgang Puzai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi. Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, Alliance, is coming under criticism for saying its presidential candidate, Hakainde Hichilema, was stopped from campaigning in the Copper Belt region Saturday. Critics dismissed it as a political stunt to score sympathy, political points ahead of next week's general election. Thabo Kawana is the media director for the opposition UPND Alliance. He tells VOA's Peter Klote that the alliance will continue to win the hearts and minds of the prospective voters ahead of the general election.
Well, it is among the tactics that the Patriotic Front are using to block the UPND from campaigning. They do not want to see Hakainde Hichilema campaign throughout the country because of the massive love and pouring of support that the people are showing to him. So what happens now is that every time he announces where he's going next, the president rushes there, literally to just go and hover around. And when that happens, the Air Force says you cannot share the same airspace with the president. The Copper Belt is a very big province with over 11 districts, 14 in fact. But you will find that when the president is in one district, the entire airspace is closed because the president is there. Whether they block or not, we are winning these elections.
But Thabo, some people are suggesting that if your presidential candidate becomes aware that the president is traveling to the same place and due to security concerns, the Zambia Air Force closes the airspace as the president visits a place, which they said is routine, why wouldn't your presidential candidate just amend his plans and travel to somewhere else or wait after the president leaves, then he can continue with his campaign?
Remember that we all give our schedules to the Electoral Commission of Zambia, where we will be and when. The president has already been. What we did was to wait for the president to do his rounds. And when he has done with an area, that is when we go there. But what is happening now is that when President Hakainde announces, according to his schedule, that next we are coming this side, the president will go back there. Like I've said, this is almost the 10th time the president is going back to the Copper Belt. He was there 4 days ago. He was there the other week. He was there throughout the last month. So today's visit of the president to the Copper Belt really is unscheduled. And that is the surest way they can use to prevent the opposition from campaigning, by making sure that where President Hakainde announces he's going next, the president will go there. And in some instances, the president doesn't even go there. They just say the president will be coming and he doesn't show up. But just by saying the president will be coming, they close the airspace.
Supporters of the PF are suggesting that the outcry of the opposition that they are being blocked or being prevented from campaigning is just a mere publicity stunt to gain sympathy votes from Zambians, and that this has been the tradition all along. How do you respond to that?
It is a fallacy for them to suggest it in that manner. We are glad that we have international observers on the ground. They are able to see what is going on, that we are literally being blocked from campaigning. So even if the president is on the Copper Belt and we say we are going to Northern Province, we will find police there blocking us from entering the Northern Province, even discharging tear gas canisters to disperse the people, and they will arrest our leaders like they continue doing just to stop us from campaigning. Can you imagine a situation where in an official campaign period, the opposition are getting arrested for campaigning? That is unheard of. We had such situations before in the past where the police attempted to interfere with the elections, and the then Electoral Commission of Zambia chairperson, Justice Bobby Warrior, he's late now, may his soul rest in peace, he instructed the Inspector General of Police not to interfere with the election calendar.
So what is the plan to circumvent what you describe as a major obstacle in your campaigning efforts ahead of the elections?
Remember that we have got foot soldiers on the ground. The campaign message was already sold. We have secured a buy-in for our message from the Zambian people. The decision is made. The die is cast. The election is on Thursday. And no matter what they do, we are winning these elections with a landslide within the first round. And once we form government after Thursday, we are coming to demonstrate to the Zambian people what a democratic state is. We are restoring democracy, the rule of law, and civility back in the country, so that as a opposition political party, which will include the Patriotic Front now in opposition, will know that democracy entails that you give space to other political parties to sell their message to the people.
That was Thabo Kawana, the media director for the opposition UPND Alliance. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty. As new and more potent coronavirus variants emerge and reports show some vaccines declining in efficacy, countries, mostly in the developed world, are getting ready to provide booster shots. But many health experts say they are not needed, at least yet, and the World Health Organization says available vaccines should go first to the unvaccinated in less developed countries. VOA's correspondent Mariama Diallo looks into it.
After many pleas to make more vaccines available to low and middle income countries, the World Health Organization this week called for a moratorium on wealthy countries giving their citizens COVID-19 booster shots. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General.
We cannot and we should not accept countries that have already used most of the global supply of vaccines using even more of it, while the world's most vulnerable people remain unprotected.
On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the U.S. is doing its part, but also wants to be prepared in case the boosters are needed down the road.
I feel that it's a false choice and that we can do both. We announced just yesterday that we hit an important milestone of over 110 million vaccines donated to the world. That is more than any other country has shared combined. And we also started to donate the 500 million doses of Pfizer we've purchased.
China also this week pledged to supply 2 billion vaccine doses to other countries this year, promising to donate $100 million to COVAX, the program that aims to distribute vaccines to low and middle income countries. This comes after Israel became the first country to start offering a third Pfizer COVID-19 shot to older citizens a week ago. Other countries, including Germany and Britain, say they will start administering booster shots in September. Health experts weigh in. Jessica Holzer from the University of New Haven.
I believe the World Health Organization's moratorium is to try to reduce the implications of desperation for a booster shot in the U.S. or in Europe on overall worldwide vaccine supply. And I think it's a very important effort to really establish equity.
William Schaffner from Vanderbilt University Medical Center.
Well, obviously, we have many people around the world who still haven't gotten their first shots. And I think that's where most of our attention should be directed at the present time before we start boosting other people's protection.
Krishna Udayakuwar, Duke Global Health Innovation Center Director.
I think what we need to do is keep reminding everybody here that it's not one pandemic in the U.S. and another pandemic in Africa. This is a global pandemic. The boosters are becoming necessary partially because of the duration of immunity, which means we're not vaccinating people around the world fast enough to reduce the risk of infections. And secondly, because of new variants that are emerging, what we need to do is keep reminding everybody here that it's not one pandemic in the U.S. and another pandemic in Africa. This is a global pandemic. The boosters are becoming necessary partially because of the duration of immunity, which means we're not vaccinating people around the world fast enough to reduce the risk of infections. And secondly, because of new variants that are emerging.
Last month, Pfizer put in a request to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to authorize the booster dose of its COVID-19 vaccine as soon as possible. That was based on evidence that showed an erosion on the vaccine's efficacy after 6 months, as well as reduced efficacy against the highly contagious Delta variant. Once again, Jessica Holzer from the University of New Haven.
I think it's important to remember that waning is a downward slope, but that doesn't mean that it goes from 95%, where Pfizer, which I know is the first company to come out and suggest a booster, 95% efficacy against the Alpha variant and even sustained efficacy against the Delta variant and other variants. That going down doesn't mean that you are no longer protected.
Schaffner says he's happy to have boosters approved for use on the shelf, ready to go if needed, but it doesn't look like that's the case quite yet.
Well, the Delta variant now accounts for over 90% of new infections in the United States. And although we have had an upsurge of hospitalizations, they're almost all in unvaccinated persons. So that means that the vaccines are really working against Delta. They're keeping vaccinated people out of the hospital. And that, of course, was the principal goal of the vaccines.
And it's important to differentiate between immediate needs versus intermediate and long-term needs, Udayakumar says.
In the long term, we know that we have to ramp up significantly vaccine manufacturing capacity, and a lot of investments have happened. We're now starting to see investments in low and middle income countries, including in India, in South Africa, in Senegal.
On Thursday, Moderna said its vaccine continues to be 93% effective 6 months after the second dose. The company also said it believes a booster shot will be necessary before winter. Meanwhile, boosters could play a role for a particular group, Schaffner notes.
One of the groups that we're concerned about here in the United States, and I think also in Europe and around the world, are people who are immune compromised. You know, they're immune system didn't respond as well to the vaccines because they are immune impaired. And the question is, could those people benefit from a third dose? And that might well be. You might even think of it not so much as a booster, but actually a three-dose initial series.
Questioned by VOA, the White House said Friday the administration's scientists are also considering whether to recommend a booster for immune-compromised individuals. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The United Nations Children's Fund says West and Central African accounts for a significant proportion of open defecation, with about 116 million people engaged in the practice globally. Nigeria ranks second in the world with 8 million people, while eight countries of the region, including Ghana, has more than 5 million people following the practice. Mavis Ochere in Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more.
Only four countries in West and Central Africa, namely Cabo Verde, Gambia, Guinea, and Mali, are on track to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal of ending open defecation by 2030. UNICEF says most countries are making progress, but at a slow pace. In an effort to end the practice, UNICEF plans to engage young people aged between 10 to 24 years in Ghana and Nigeria to embark on a hackathon or competition that will encourage them to share their promising ideas and innovative solutions to end the unsanitary practice. Loretta Roberts, a UNICEF specialist based in Ghana, says in 2017, Accra launched the campaign in partnership with the Ministry of Sanitation and Water Resources to end open defecation. She says the regional office of UNICEF in West and Central Africa pushed the campaign through another initiative called the No Poop Challenge, and recognizing what was already done in Ghana, the country was selected to pilot the initiative encouraging youth to contribute to the elimination of the practice. Robert says young people are engaged in the fight because many young people have new ideas they can bring on board. They also have the capacity to work with their peers to help significantly reduce open defecation. Robert says participants of the hackathon initiative are expected to send their ideas and innovations that can be scaled up across countries.
These ideas can cut across various initiatives. For instance, they can be ideas that help people know how much open defecation is a big problem in our country. They can be ideas that look at the latrines that people use and how those latrines can be made stronger, or how people can ensure that their latrines are used better to ensure the flies don't have access to it. So there's such a broad spectrum of things that young people can do.
Robert says the campaign is not a one-off event, but something that will continue until Ghana ends open defecation. She says pertaining to this year's challenge, UNICEF hopes to announce a winner in November who will join counterparts of Nigeria in a multi-country challenge. And out of that effort, a regional championship would emerge. She says there needs to be concerted efforts by everyone in the country to change their attitude towards defecating in the open, and for government to help sensitize people and provide the deprived with sanitation facilities.
Some resources are required to facilitate this engagement. Then also, they are the poorest of the poor who will struggle to put up a decent sanitation facility for themselves. So for these ones, there is the need for some targeted support. There's a need for programs that cut across the entire country, which lets people know that they need to take sanitation as a personal development issue. And all these call for funding.
Robert says a research from the World Bank shows that Ghana loses close to $79 million annually due to the practice. She says information from the World Health Organization and other groups show that open defecation can be linked to various diseases, including cholera and diarrhea. Health experts note that the continuing practice, along with other unsanitary conditions, has led to a resurgence of polio in Ghana.
In terms of young people, I think the challenge here is that especially for those under five, they are the ones that are most susceptible to some of these diseases. And unfortunately, it could result in death. There's another information we have from WHO, which shows that in 2015, there are about 3,600 children who had actually died from diarrhea.
She says currently in Ghana, about 30% of persons living in rural areas practice open defecation, while nearly 11.5% of persons residing in urban areas adhere to the practice. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Ochere in Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
An exhibition that opened Thursday in the Kenyan capital aims to shed light on a long list of cases in which Kenyan police are accused of extrajudicial killings. Ruth Elmendop reports from Nairobi.
We're in a Nairobi gallery at an exposition about police brutality. In a white room, there are black and white photos that show saddened women holding signboards that list a name. One woman, Sarah Wangari, is among them. In October 2017, police allegedly shot and killed Wangari's 19-year-old son, Alex, in a poor section of Nairobi. She says he had gone out to fetch water, and when he didn't come back, she went out to find him. Wangari says she found her son on the ground, dead, with two police officers next to his body, making phone calls. The shooting happened close to her home, and she still passes the spot every day.
When I'm going to buy food to eat, I see here, I'm feeling very bad.
Wangari says she went to the police, but they refused to open a case, alleging that her son was a gangster. Alex Wangari is one of the 18 alleged victims of police brutality, featured in this exhibit, organized by the Mathare Social Justice Center. Their stories are also detailed in the book. Wangoi Kimari works at the center.
This exposition builds on the documentation we've already done as Mathare Social Justice Center to allow the family members who've been bereaved through state-sanctioned killings to tell their side of the story in ways that charge against the narrative that their children were suspects or thieves.
The center documented 99 police killings in Mathare and neighboring slums from 2018 to 2021. And 803 killings across Kenya from 2013 to 2016. The exposition in an upmarket gallery is meant to provoke changes, says Wangoi Kimari.
So we need to assemble, we need to get as much cross-class solidarity as possible to enact more pressure on the state. The institutions like the Independent Police Oversight Authority, who also need pressure.
Police in Kenya rarely comment on allegations of police killings and brutality. VOA reached out to police officials several times for this story, but they did not make anyone available for an interview. The exposition is scheduled to run for 7 days. For Sarah Wangari, the photos that were taken are a permanent record of what happened and symbolize hope that she's not alone and help is on the way. Ruth Elmendorp for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Netland Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports and music from our African collection. And now in Northern Africa sports, the Olympics Tokyo 2020 winds up. Perez Jepchichir won the women's marathon as Kenya claimed a 1-2 in Japan's northern city of Sapporo. Jepchichir beat world record holder Bridget Kosgei in the closing stages to win in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 20 seconds. Kosgei, a 2-time London Marathon winner, who broke Britain's Paula Radcliffe's 16-year-old record at the Chicago Marathon in 2019, finished 16 seconds behind Jepchichir and 10 seconds ahead of American Mole Sido. On Friday, Uganda's Joshua Cheptegei and Kenya's Faith Kipyegon both won gold medals. Cheptegei won the men's 5,000 meters to take his second medal of the games after a silver in the 10,000 meters, while Kipyegon retained the 1,500 meters title she won at the Rio Games 5 years ago. The 27-year-old Cheptegei finished ahead of Canada's Somali-born Mohamed Ahmed, who won silver, and USA's Kenyan-born Paul Chelimo, who took bronze, to add to his silver from the Rio Games. Cheptegei became the first Ugandan in history to claim 2 Olympic medals after he won silver in the men's 10,000 meters a week ago. Meanwhile, Peruth Chemutai became the first Ugandan woman to win an Olympic medal as she took gold in the women's 3,000 meters steeplechase on day 12 of the Tokyo Games. Kenya's Haivin Kieng claimed the bronze. In the men's 800 meters, Kenya's Emmanuel Korir clinched gold just ahead of his compatriot Ferguson Rotich. Poland's Patrick Dobek took bronze, with former Sudanese refugee Peter Ball coming in fourth place, running for Australia. Elsewhere, FIFA banned its former vice president and ex-president of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Issa Hayatou, for 1 year. FIFA found the 70-year-old Cameroonian responsible for having breached the article relating to duty of loyalty in its code of ethics. FIFA's investigation centered on Hayatou's involvement in the deal struck with Lagardère Sports over the media and marketing rights of the competitions organized by CAF while he was president of the African football's governing body. The ruling means that Hayatou is banned from taking part in any kind of football-related activity at both national and international level for 1 year, and he was fined just over $33,000. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Nishike we utanichafua basi toa leso jifute jasho ta kama kuna jua toleka
jifute 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 jifute
ukichoka kushoto jifute kulia we
jifute jifute
ayo
jifute jifute
ayo
jifute jifute
fire waludishe shule.
Yeah.
body talk to me nice. Saying I'm my love, you didn't need for your life. Yeah, I love no be like. Say every day together, yeah, day and night. Yeah, if I leave, you go bye. Yeah, if you leave, I go
stroking
bye.
Your back, baby. Loving your body, baby. As you're whining your body, baby. So crazy. Loving your body, baby. Girl, you want me to me.
Yeah.
Kita, kita, kita minah. dream. Baby, hold me tight. You said you'd never leave me, yeah. Je peux pas vivre sans toi. Je suis perdu sans toi, baby. Vas-y, vas-y, comme ça, c'est bon, baby. J'adore, baby. Ma nana, j'ai nos je peux pas vivre sans toi. Je suis perdu sans toi, baby. Vas-y, vas-y, comme ça. C'est bon, baby. J'adore, baby. Ma nana, j'ai notre
I know feet, die for nothing. what's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all depending. They got it, ride the wind. I know if you die or not. Make you no say anything when you do, they must commend it.
I can't come and keep myself.
So anything when you do, I they try to do it on my way.
I can't come and keep myself.
Plenty, plenty, plenty survive we face. Just to make sure money day. But my people then go say, I don't want buy, I don't want die, I don't want payment. I want enjoy, I want job life, I want buy motor, I want build house, I still want to know. Tell me, what's it come? G-Wagon. All the Bentley, the Galton, ride the bull, I know feet, dive or not. What's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, the Galton, ride the me, I know feet. Different things them happening, schemes and packaging. In a one night for shows, I'm juggling. Flow like the ocean, my boat, I'm paddling. Shara Shinapella, that's my bro, my family. Frozen trees. When it comes to money, I take concentrate. Make a tell you straight, you are not my mate. If you become a shan, I be head of state. But my people then go say, I know one buy, I know one die, I know one payment. I want enjoy, I want job life, I want buy motor, I want build house, I still want to know. What's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, the Galton, ride the boat, I know feet, dive or not. What's it gonna be? G-Wagon, all the Bentley, the Galton, ride the boat, I know feet, dive or not. Oh, no, I'm born now.
Our Sunday music spot on Nathan Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nathan Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.